Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. So Mona, I know the last couple of episodes, we've been talking about the new changes to the regulations of the EB5 industry, and we've somewhat stayed at a high level. A lot of it in that first episode was essentially breaking news. It was less than 12 hours, and we recorded that night to get it out that morning.
That's right. That's right. We had myself here and Rebecca from London, sitting in London, recording it at the same time.
I remember. Yeah, it was a late night for us all, and we got it out really quick, and then we followed up with another episode on the regulations. But now today is going to be a little bit different.
Right. Well, the last episode when we had Leon Rodriguez was really a different angle to what we intend to today, Mark. Today, we were so lucky to have Robert Devine from Baker Donaldson to give us a deep analysis, which is really what I feel people want to know. Now that they've had the breaking news, they want to know, all right, so how does it affect me and what do we do moving forward?
A deep dive now makes sense because for the last couple of weeks, we've covered it at a somewhat high level. And Robert Devine is the perfect guest to help us cover it. Robert is the leader of Baker Donaldson's Global Immigration Group and works from the firm's Washington, D.C. and their Chattanooga offices, concentrating his practice in business immigration and litigation. Robert, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you.
Mark, there's more to Robert than that. You forgot that he's also Chief Counsel of USCIS, as well as Acting Director, and he's been Vice President of IIUSA for almost, or I would say more than 7 years. Isn't that correct, Robert?
Yes, I was elected Vice President for 7 years of IIUSA.
Time runs by so quickly.
Yes.
So, here we go. Robert, the regs, are they actually coming? We would like to hear your opinion on possible litigation, draft legislation, because we've been talking about draft legislation on this program for some time, and we did mention possible litigation with Leon Rodriguez on our last episode.
You know, there may be somebody who brings litigation about this reg saying that somehow it was not properly done or was improperly thought through, but I think those kinds of challenges are unlikely to be effective. So I think the regulation will take effect as scheduled unless some legislation is enacted by Congress between now and then. That's possible, but it seems not very likely.
It may be, I don't know what to say about not likely, because surely the very fact that there is a 120-day grace period shows that perhaps USCIS did think that there might be some legislation coming through.
Well, that certainly was not mentioned in the preamble to the regulations. The reason for a 120-day period before it took effect was to allow projects that are trying to raise money under the current arrangements and which have a targeted employment area designation right now would have a chance to complete their fundraising under the current rules. Otherwise, they would have better chances at some kind of litigation based on, you know, a surprise and a hardship to the projects that suddenly lose their funding.
I hate to say, but I do have a feeling that you are correct, and I'm glad you have said that, because there have been people out there saying, don't worry, it's not going to happen, but I do see it happening. I am hoping, and we are still pushing. I know we're pushing at IIUSA to get the draft legislation through. But right now, I do feel that we are probably in a stronger position to say, if we had to do a prediction, that the regs would come through before the legislation.
Well, let's just make clear. The regs have been published. They will take effect. The only thing that could happen is something could intervene to interrupt that effect, such as legislation.
Wow. You have written an amazing piece straight after the regs were actually announced, and I want to ask you some questions about that, as well as some of your opinions as to what we're really going to see and what's going to happen moving forward. The first point that I'd like to make, though, is what you have already alluded to, that many projects may not get funding after November. And I know that in the draft legislation, in the regs, USCIS have mentioned that 54% of projects, current projects, would be affected. What's going to happen to these projects and what's going to happen to the investors if they do not get funding in the next 3 months or 2 months?
Well, I think what you referred to about the 54% is the number of projects that qualified under a TEA as a TEA.
That's correct.
Under the current regulations, but that will not qualify under the new regulations. So those projects will basically be unable to raise any money because nobody is going to invest $1.8 million when they can choose to invest $900,000 somewhere else.
Or $500,000 before they go into effect, right? So
not right.
only the investment hurdle rates go up, but the TEAs change. So that project, or the 54%, those investors before would need to put in $500,000. Then after November 21st, they would have to put in $1.8 million, is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, the reality is that anybody who plans to raise money in EB-5 in the next 2 years needs to raise it all in the next 4 months. Because anybody who's thinking about investing in EB-5 right now is going to jump in at $500,000. And there will be very few people who are interested after that in investing at $900,000. There'll be a period of desert in the EB-5 landscape for a time until people get used to the fact that it is $900,000.
Right. There is a psychological sort of assessment that has to happen. I understand.
And Robert, to your point earlier, when you said why this 120-day period, that's essentially for the projects that are in TEAs now, but will not be in a TEA after November 21st, 2019. This unusually long amount of time has been given because they realize it's a significant impact. And I guess they agree with you that now is the time to raise your money.
It's true that a project that will not be qualifying as a TEA after November 21st will have an extraordinarily difficult time raising any EB-5 capital. But even projects that still would qualify could have a very difficult time in the early going under the new regulation, just because the market will have been exhausted by the investment of people in these next few months at $500,000.
So I'm going to give you a couple of questions from that scenario, and these are kind of heavy-duty questions. Do you envisage regional centers closing whilst perhaps they still have investors, but just basically saying, well, if I can't raise any more investors now, I can't raise more capital, I don't want to be open anymore? Because that's what we have suggested previously. What's going to happen to those investors if the regional center does close? I'll start with that.
Okay. Well, I mean, regional centers are supposed to continue to operate and monitor the investments even after they've raised money. And if they don't have a meaningful prospect of raising new money, they still have the job of making sure that the money that has been raised is spent properly and reporting annually about that. And with hope, those regional centers have made arrangements with the enterprises they typically contracted with to receive fees on an ongoing basis to cover the expense associated with that. The regional centers also do have to pay a filing fee to USCIS of $3,035 when they submit the annual report about what's going on in their regional center. They need to make sure they're getting that covered.
Right.
Anybody who's investing needs to make sure that the regional center sponsoring their project has leadership that are responsible people and who are young enough to last long enough to do this work that may go on for instance, for a Chinese investor for 20 years.
Yeah, I feel that this is such a huge issue. But the other point was that and it was brought up by somebody at an event recently, that should capital not be forthcoming from EB5, it would have to come from some other alternative method, such as bridge, which would then increase the cost of capital, which would then in turn change all of the mathematics within the project. And perhaps investors may either not get the return of their funds or not get the interest rate, because just because the maths have all been askewed.
Right. And if there's not enough money spent, they might not get or keep their green card because the jobs might not get created. I mean, the fact that EB5 investors get to claim the job creation credit from all the money in the deal means that the projects are sort of leveraged on the other money for job creation. And if all the other money isn't raised, of course, yes, the project wouldn't get completed and not enough jobs may be created to cover the immigration benefits of the investors. And you mentioned earlier what happens if the regional centers get terminated because they quit filing the reports. That could be fatal to the immigration processing for investors who have that happen to them before they reach the point in their immigration process of actually immigrating to the United States, getting an immigrant visa and entering, or getting approval of adjustment of status.
Well, right now, it is a material change if you switch over regional centers, correct?
That's right. I mean, I guess the termination of a regional center or switching over from one to another would either of those would be a material change, and you'd have to start over with a new I-526 using the new regional center, new place in the queue, everything.
Right.
Terrible result.
Maybe we should just explain a little bit for our listeners. So every year, a regional center must file, must complete compliance with the fee. If they don't, that is reason enough for USCIS to terminate them. So if your project is in a regional center and that regional center is not doing the compliance work that they're supposed to, perhaps because they don't have the incentive or they're not making the money, and the regional center is closed, and at this point in time, if you pick up your petition or your project and move to another regional center, USCIS will consider that a material change and ask you to refile, correct?
That's true. And there may be situations where investors may make a move to take over a regional center and actually maybe buy the regional center from the regional center owners who don't wish to continue maintaining it anymore.
Yeah, that's a possibility. It perhaps would have been more likely with perhaps some of the Chinese clients because they have some kind of leadership with an agent. But with a lot of the new projects where individual investors are coming from all over the place with no one agent, I don't see that being as easily done because just because one investor would not know who the other investor was or who to even approach.
Well, many state laws require the new commercial enterprise they invested in to maintain a list and share with investors the list of all the other investors. And there may be an ability of investors to band together, even if they didn't come through the same agent.
The other big question, which we're questions which are coming to us, Robert, are things like investors asking if the money has increased, is there more likelihood of an additional visa coming? Is there an ability to retain or port an old priority date from, say, an EB2 or an EB3? Would any of these areas be changed?
Well, the regulation does not do anything about the number of visas that are available under the statute. Any change to how many visas are available and how the waiting lists would be maintained would have to be done by new legislation, which is very unlikely in the political climate that we face.
Yeah, wow. And I think you mentioned in your article, your wonderful article, which I really would tell everybody to go out and read, is that you really envisage a scramble and a lot of investors going and just filing while it's still 500 and there being a sudden increase in the waiting line as a result of that.
Yes. I think anybody who's thinking about EB5 as their path to obtain permanent residence really needs to consider that this is the last best time to do it at a reasonable price. You mentioned whether people can carry their EB3 priority date or EB2 priority date. I think it's very important to understand that the new regulation allows for an investor who receives an approved I-526 under the EB5 program, the first step, when they get that approval, if they then experience some problem with their investment and even suffer a revocation that's not something that reflected on whether the project was really qualified in the first place, they can file a new 526, maybe based on another investment, and get to grab the place in the queue for visa numbers that was established by the filing of their first 526. But it's important to understand, particularly for investors from India and China, who are huge participants in, as countries, in the EB2 and EB3 categories that are accomplished by the filing of an I-140, those people cannot carry a priority date for them that was established through the filing of an I-140 or an underlying labor certification. Only a 526 approval can result in carrying a priority date to another I-526. It doesn't cross over to I-140s either direction.
I think that's very important to point that out. The other thing I really want to ask you, Robert, because you're the first person who's brought this issue up, when there's a rush, whenever we have seen a rush of filings, there's a lot of skeletal filings. And one of the points of a skeletal filing are people who would invest or file with less than 500,000. We know for a fact that there are regional centers out there saying, it's okay, you can file with 250 and you can put 250 in a promissory note. Now, you have advised against this.
Well, I have advised against it just because fitting the rules that are triggered by trying to do that is actually very difficult. The law does say that an investor can be approved based on being in the process of investing, which suggests they haven't completed the investment. The regulation mentions that in the preamble, but it talks only about the situation where money is placed into escrow. And in that respect, the investor is in the process of investing because they've got the whole money in escrow or most of it in escrow and the other part has been released. And then some of it or all of it will be released after they file based on some conditions in an escrow agreement. That's one thing. That's very common and not a problem. But it is possible to put less than the full amount into either escrow or into the new commercial enterprise. And owe the rest, O-W-E, to owe the rest, as you mentioned, with some kind of promissory note. But USCIS, through its regulations and through a designated precedent decision from the late 90s, says that if that's going to happen, the amount that's still owed by the investor to the NCE must be secured in legal documents that protect the enterprise, the new commercial enterprise, and give that enterprise the right to enforce that promissory note against real assets that are worth that much in the country where those assets are held. And those assets must be the personal assets of the investor. That's a lot to get right.
Right.
I've very rarely seen that done properly.
The other thing is, if that happens, most people have their assets in a different country. They don't have assets here.
Right. So the security interest on the promissory note must be perfected under the laws of the place where the assets exist. And there must be a value to those assets that after execution of the security interest, you know, levying on the property is enough to cover the investment. That's a lot to prove.
So my advice really is to stay away from that unless you really have something specific. And I would say, for example, if you're going to put an example to what you have just said, it's perhaps a sale of property which you already have in the United States, which has been delayed for any reason. You could do a promissory note on that when you know that you have money coming from there because it's enforceable in this country. But sale of property sitting in India is not enforceable if you're sitting here because of the lack of jurisdiction.
Let's shift gears and talk about another topic, specifically targeted employment areas. Mona, you pointed out earlier that 54% of all projects are going to move out of a target employment area after November 21st, 2019, which means that their minimum investment is going to go from $500,000 to $1.8 million. I mean, that's 3.6 times more. And honestly, I think that is a pretty big issue that we should talk about.
Mark, I agree. I think the TEA issue is much, much bigger than the 500 to 900, which quite frankly was expected. Robert, how would you suggest the TEA is now explained to the average developer?
Well, let's remember, the TEA is always still about the money. I mean, there are two issues. What's the minimum amount of investment at the two levels? But the TEA is about how do you trigger being able to use the lower level? I mean, in a world in which it's either 900,000 or 1.8 million, nobody is going to invest, almost nobody is going to invest 1.8 million. So it's still, like today, going to be absolutely necessary for a project to be qualified as a TEA, a targeted employment area, either in a rural area, and as defined by the Immigration Service under the statute, is very rural, not in a town of 20,000 and not in a metropolitan statistical area. Usually when you're in one of those places, you feel like you're in the country because you are. So that it's either got to be that or it's got to be in a high unemployment area that now is defined differently. No longer can developers or figure out with economists, you know, snake-like shapes that can grab on one end the area where they want the project to be that's not itself high unemployment area with another area that has super high unemployment so that the weighted average of the overall contiguously connected snake-like area can have the requisite 150% of the national average of unemployment. Instead, the rules say you have to take the spot where the project is located, where the jobs are being created, and take that census tract that in which that project is located, which is a pretty small area, much smaller than a city. That single census tract must have 150% of the national average, or you can connect that census tract with one or more census tracts that literally touch that one. So you could connect it with all of the census tracts that surround it or with any combination of the census tracts that surround it. But you can't go any farther than one census tract away from the area where the project is located.
Ah. So essentially what you're saying is no more long commutes to work.
But isn't that only for MSAs of over 20,000?
Which is probably most of them.
MSAs of over 20,000.
Yeah, metropolitan statistical area versus the rural small population. Yeah, that's...
Well, I mean, no. If an area is outside of a town of 20,000 and outside of an MSA, it's rural, right?
Okay.
If it's outside of an MSA and it has 20,000 people in it, it's not rural, and you'd have to establish that that town is a high unemployment area.
Right. So essentially, we are looking at completely cutting out all the large metropolitan cities. That would be the entire New York City, L.A., Miami, completely.
If it's in a rural area as defined, then you don't need to worry about high unemployment area. You don't need that. Rural is all you need.
Right.
So anything that's not rural could be eligible to be designated as high unemployment area. The rule, there's three types of areas that can be shown to be a high unemployment area just by virtue of federally published data about the whole area. So that's a metropolitan statistical area. So if you can show that the entire MSA has an unemployment rate of 150% of the national average, that's all you need to show. Same thing with a county that's inside of an MSA or inside of a city or town outside of an MSA, not a county outside of an MSA, just a city. That's what the rule says. Otherwise, you have to go for a special designation under this sort of bullseye concept where you can look at either just the census tract where the project is located or that plus any combination of the census tracts that touch that tract. Does that make sense?
I think it does. So I want to paint an example. For example, Detroit, Michigan. If we can envision that that area has a high unemployment rate, which I think is somewhere around 8 to 9% last time I checked. Obviously, it's a metropolitan area. It's a metropolitan statistical area. So if your project is in one of the metro areas and that census tract is 1.5 times greater than obviously the national average for unemployment, bingo, you're in a TEA. Or
no,
if not,
you just confused two things.
Okay.
you can show that the whole MSA has 150% of the national average unemployment rate.
Oh, so the entire MSA, not just where the regional center's at. Okay.
There's two different ways to do this, to get a high unemployment area designation or have it accepted as a high unemployment area. One is to just say this whole county or this whole metropolitan area or this whole town. Is it on the whole by data published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics has 150% of the national average. That's it. Nothing about a bullseye. If you can't show that whole area, and there are very few places where the entire town or the entire MSA or the entire county has 150% of the national average unemployment rate, if you can't show that, then you have to show this project is located in a census tract that it has 150% of the national average, or this census tract plus some combination of the ones touching it have a weighted average of 150% of the national average. That's what it takes to get a TEA.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with my thing with the census tracts. And
so here's my take on this, though. We've put together hundreds of projects, as I'm sure you have, Robert, over the years, and it has dawned on us some time ago that there is such a huge difference in the assumption of the return of capital from a metropolitan area like New York City as opposed to a rural area. The figures are just so different. You don't have that same kind of return. And this money is at risk. Surely now we're talking about people putting their money into a project and really having no certainty of a return of capital.
Well, I'm just no expert on, you know, what kinds of projects are more likely to provide a return on capital. There certainly has been, up to now, a demonstrable preference by investors toward big money center cities.
Right.
And that's going to be harder to set up projects that qualify anymore. And so people who want to participate are going to have to be willing to risk their money in other areas. People may be able to come up with projects that are very likely to be successful. I'm not going to.
I'm sure. All those things. No, I agree. I don't see this as the demise of EB5. I'm just being a little cynical and a little bit more wary that it's not going to be as easy and as straightforward as it has been. But saying that, you are correct. There are many aspects to the return of capital, including capital stacks and the developers, etc. Robert, we sound a little gloomy and down because obviously this is change and change always brings a new perspective. But what do you actually see about with the EB5 program? Where do you see it going?
Well, obviously we're going to have 120 days of big sale and people who are interested jumping in and getting it done. And there will be desert-like circumstances for a while after November 21st because the demand of the moment will have been exhausted, but it won't be exhausted forever. There will be people who newly become aware of the program, want to use it, have the money, and particularly are coming from countries that will not be facing drastic waits for visa numbers. And they probably will be more interested in investments that offer more meaningful return on investment, financial return on investment, and not just for EB5. And people from countries that are backlogged may still be willing to do it because it's still the best way for them to get themselves or a family member immigrated to the U.S. But it probably will be more of an investment for return on capital.
Right. That's what I was going to say.
With EB5 as an afterthought. Mm. So people will be offering investments to say, hey, here's a great investment. And by the way, we've set it up to work with EB5, so you can get a green card out of it if you want it.
Right. I see a mix more with private equity. I also see some countries bringing in capital and opening up businesses, doing more of their own entrepreneurial type of projects as opposed to going into a big project, for sure. So I do see EB5 being there, and I think you see the same, but we just see a different EB5.
And it may be that if investment is stifled so much, that may be what it takes for Congress to re-engineer EB-5 and give it more numbers and make it be something for the future.
Right, because once November 21st happens, it doesn't stop Congress from coming in and perhaps bringing in legislation later if we don't get it in the September season.
Well, let's hope that favorable legislation comes out sooner, vice later, if it does at all. Robert Devine, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice and helping us deep dive into these new changes in the EB-5 program.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.